I've been reporting on prisons for the Progressive magazine for about 8 years. I've done reporting on restraint chairs, on stun belts, on HIV treatment in prisons and jails, and other issues too. And so when I heard about Abu Ghraib, and actually I was on vacation when this story broke, and so I was hearing bits and pieces of it, and I also heard people expressing anger, people around me, that this was happening. And when I started, you know, one of the first things I saw was the photo that is now quite famous of someone who's wearing a hood and a robe and who's strung with electrical wiring. When I saw that, the first thing I thought of was the Sacramento County City Jail. That I had seen video footage of jailers at that jail on a particular shift, a night shift, who were basically, when people were disobedient, in one case, one man had asked for his lawyer repeatedly, and they told him to stop asking for his lawyer, asking to speak to his lawyer. They would, the deputies there would put a spit mask on a person, which is something they can't see through, and pull them into a restraint chair, strap them in, and then in numerous cases told them they were about to be electrocuted. At least in some cases, told them they were about to be electrocuted. So this photo seemed familiar to me. It seemed, and then the more stories I heard, the more I thought, well, you know, this sounds American. It sounds like our prisons and jails, and I don't think we should be too surprised that we've exported that.
You go on to list numerous details of similarities. But before we move on to some of the others, I wanted to ask you about this one in Sacramento, because there was a lawsuit,
right,
you mentioned, and I was wondering if you knew what the outcome of that was.
It led to a settlement, and a very large settlement, on behalf of the people who'd been put in restraint chairs. I mean, just to be a little more detailed about that lawsuit, it's more detailed than is in this article. There were people who were put in that restraint chair who were brought into the jail, and they'd been charged with being drunk in public, and in some cases those charges were later dropped. There were people who were put in the restraint chair there who were put in because they were depressed, or there were people who were put in there, their faces covered with a spit mask, and who were screaming, you know, don't let me die, don't let me die. And in one case, there was a man who was strapped into a restraint chair in 96. His name was Carmelo Marrero, who was in the restraint chair who I believe, if I remember rightly, was on drugs, and who died after being strapped to that restraint chair. So it was a complicated case, but one of the things that was familiar to me was this fact that they were masked, and then that the guards performed mock executions on them. That's something that, you know, the Guardian of London reported that it had learned. It reported on May 14th that it had learned of ordinary soldiers who were taught to perform mock executions. So that statement too reminded me of the jail.
There's also the pictures that we're all familiar with of inmates being, I'm not sure what the right word for it, but we'll say abused, using dogs. And that reminded you of another case in the United States?
In fact, yeah, those were the two incidents that made me decide to do this story. In the United States, a few years ago, there was a big news story. It ended up on the television of about this training video used at Brazoria County Detention Center, which is in Texas. And it showed, as part of the training video, guards using dogs to threaten and bite inmates. And it also had footage of beating stun gun use, but the dogs were one of the big things that caught the eye of the media at that point. So that when Seymour Hirsch did his amazing reporting for The New Yorker about Abu Ghraib, and one of the things he was pointing out was that these dogs were being used to bite inmates, that seems very similar to a famous incident here in the United States.
And this goes on and on and on in your article. There are countless examples of similarities.
Right. Well, what I did was approach my editor and say, look, there are a lot of similarities from my first look at this. It just seems as though we can look through these reports and we're probably going to find more. And that's really what I did, was start looking, for instance, at shackling, looking at things like long-term solitary confinement, and also urination policies. I mean, basically, here in the United States, when I had done reporting on the restraint chair, I had incidents where people were being strapped in the chair and then forced to defecate on themselves or urinate on themselves. And in at least one case, it was actually jail policy. That was in Ventura County, California. And it was another lawsuit that led to a preliminary injunction banning the chair in that county. But it was, according to that lawsuit, according to that preliminary injunction, jail policy allowed deputies to require restrained arrestees to either urinate or defecate on themselves and be forced to sit in their own feces or hold it. Now, you know, both in this case and in the case in Sacramento, we're not always talking about people who've gone through the whole trial system and been convicted. We're talking about people arrested in some cases and not, you know, not yet proven guilty. But in Iraq, there were a number of incidents involving people who were said they had to urinate where they sat. That included in Abu Ghraib, allegedly Charles Grainer, who's the famous guard, one of the famous guards, who was, according to news reports, very much feared by the prisoners there. He had handcuffed one man to the corner of the bed where he had to stay for days.
This is in the United States.
No, this one is in Abu Ghraib. This is Charles Grainer.
Oh, okay. But you were able to discovered something about his past as well, and that was that he had some experience in this area prior to that in the American prison system.
Two of the guards at Abu Ghraib had careers as corrections officers here in the United States, and Charles Grainer had worked at Greene County Prison in Pennsylvania, which was the location of a lawsuit involving 12 different guards. And one of the things I was interested in was whether anything similar had happened at Greene County Prison that was similar to Abu Ghraib. Now, I should say at the outset that Grainer was never implicated in this lawsuit, but he was there at the time. He was sued by an inmate who accused him of beatings and other mistreatment, but that suit ended up being dismissed. However, just to go through the similarities between Abu Ghraib and Greene.
Right.
At Abu Ghraib, according to the Army report, there was credible evidence that an inmate had suffered forced sodomy with a chemical light or perhaps a broom handle. And there were the arrangements of people in sexually explicit positions for photographing and basically public display. Also forcing groups of male detainees to masturbate themselves, for photography and videotape. And there were beatings, and this is all allegations, but according to the Army, and also guards wrote insulting epithets on their bodies. Well, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette in 1998 reported at Greene that, and this will sound familiar, guards sodomized inmates with nightsticks, conducted nude searches and in full view of other guards and prisoners, and in those searches examined every bodily orifice. And there was also an allegation that guards had used the blood of one inmate to write KKK on the floor. The very specificity of the similarities of those two, you know, places, one here in the United States, the other in Iraq, kind of shocked me, frankly. And in putting those two things next to each other so that we can see the similarities, I wasn't trying to accuse Grainer of being guilty at Green. What I'm trying to point out is that, you know, he, at the very least, moved from a prison where there was known abuse to another. And Abu Ghraib was a familiar environment. He's part of a system. And that, in some ways, is what I'm trying to argue in the article, that we have a system here in the United States where there have been repeated incidents of abuse, and we shouldn't really be shocked when we find that things like that are happening in Iraq.
In light of that, it's easy to see, I guess, that or reasonable to conclude, I should say, that there's a more systemic a problem.
One of the things, and this is not in my article, but one of the things that's repeatedly said about Abu Ghraib is that there are problems with oversight, that the prison was crowded, and that the guards were frightened, probably. The things I know about the American prison system suggest that those three things may be problems also. On oversight, I guess you'd have to go prison by prison, but I do know that in American jails, for instance, their policies on restraint chair use are all over the place. There are many, many different kinds of policies. Many of our jails and prisons are overcrowded. Many of them have mentally ill inmates. I've been in, like, my local jail, for instance, where, you know, I could hear screaming continually because the man who was screaming was mentally ill. And in those kinds of situations, and in situations where, like at Maricopa County Jail in Phoenix, where inmates are housed in tent cities and it gets very hot, those situations can be frightening for guards. They have a lot to deal with. And I think that's part of the similarity between Abu Ghraib and the U.S. also.
My instinct when I hear things like this is to immediately blame the guards.
Yeah, I mean, I there are people certainly responsible for things, but one of the things I was talking about in the article is that that really we've had a cultural shift here in the United States. I think guards work in very difficult situations. I know there are a lot of guards who do have they believe in rehabilitation, and they believe in some of the old methods, and so I guess I don't think all guards are implicated in this. And now there are some bad guards, certainly, and you know, there's certainly evidence of that. But I do think that when we have here in the United States, this was a country where we really led the way in prison reform long ago, back around the Revolutionary War time, and for a couple hundred years after that. And now we're leading the way, and we really are. Other countries are following suit. In a different direction. Since the 1990s, since the early 1990s, we've had kind of a militarization of our prisons and jails, and that's even apparent in juvenile programs. For instance, we have, you know, boot camps are very popular, and they were, especially in the 1990s, but there have been kids who died at some of those boot camp programs. I went to a law enforcement conference in 1996 that was sponsored by the American Defense Preparedness Association, which was used to sponsoring, you know, other conferences like Bomb and Warhead. So there's a really different way of thinking about prisoners here in the United States than we used to have. And to me, that all signals that we're thinking about a war here in the United States, and that prisoners are the public enemy. And that also suggests that they can't be rehabilitated. There's something else going on in our culture. If you turn on the television any night during, you know, primetime programming, what you're going to come across, even if you're just flipping through, are crime and punishment shows. You know, that's also true of video games. a lot of them talk about punishment. I feel that publicly, we Americans have a set of new set of beliefs, really, and those are that people who land in jail deserve to be there, that criminals are bad people, that they can't be rehabilitated, that punishment should therefore be as harsh as possible, and basically we don't need to know the details and we don't want to. I was trying to partly to explain to myself why, you know, I've been reporting on this for 8 years. I have seen photos, and we've published some of them, very disturbing photos. I was on a Nightline program that showed videotapes of people being put in restraint chairs that showed bruise marks from some of these devices. I was amazed. You know, Nightline, Ted Koppel's Nightline really does great reporting. And some of, you know, some of these photos have been on our television, but they don't get quite the publicity that Abu Ghraib got. And I was really trying to understand why. Because, you know, to me, seeing those things was very, very disturbing, and they haven't gotten the kind of, they haven't led to public outcry in the same way that Abu Ghraib did.
You often hear police spokespeople, when discussing crime in more general terms, refer to, and this is something I've come across, I'm certain you have as well, which is they refer to certain people as bad guys. And
yeah.
I guess that supports what you're saying.
Yeah, that's a very interesting way of talking that I think is somewhat new, although I don't have proof of it. But yeah, right, bad guys.
In you made some other specific connections. Another appalling one was an example in Utah, and you were also able to link this to an individual who was involved in that prison system and who later on went to work in Iraq at Abu Ghraib.
Right. Back in 2000, when I did reporting on the restraint chair, I found a case of a man named Michael Valente, who was a mentally ill man who was placed into a restraint chair nude, spent 16 hours there and in 1997, and he got up after being in the restraint chair and took a shower and died from a clot that went to his lungs, blood clot. He was in the prison at a time that a man named Lane McCotter, who was head of Department of Corrections in Utah, and after Valente died, McCotter resigned. McCotter, 6 years later, was in charge of reconstructing Abu Ghraib, and he has denied involvement in those abuses. But my point was, again, not that he was personally responsible, but that he's part of a system that we've really, a well-established system here in the U.S. that we have exported, we are exporting to Iraq. There was another incident that Amnesty International reported that happened while McCotter was head of the Department of Corrections in Utah. And that's of another inmate who was shackled to a steel board on a cell floor. These are called restraint boards, and inmates are either shackled face down or face up.
How common is that?
My experience is that it's very common. I haven't done reporting on those, but I've looked into it, and I've seen them. They're at my local jail. They brought them out to show me. In fact, in Utah, or is it, no, in Colorado, I believe, I may be wrong on this, but I believe it was Pueblo County, they banned the restraint chair and brought in the restraint board as a substitute for it. They're kind of used as substitutes for each other. They're, you know, one of the things I have to say with these devices is that in a situation where corrections officers feel overwhelmed by having to deal with a lot of mentally ill inmates, who maybe should not be in the prison or jails, that one way of dealing with them that seems safer is to put them on one of these devices. Unfortunately, sometimes there are struggles that result from that, and there have been deaths connected with struggles like that. But yeah, I from what I understand, these devices, these boards are very common. In the Utah State Prison case, this guy was shackled to this in a what's called a 4-point restraint. There's either 4 or 5-point restraint. That means he was tied down at four parts of his body for 12 weeks in 1995.
Did at any point when you were being shown these devices, did anyone defend their use in any terms that seemed reasonable to you, or?
I actually have spoken to the makers of these devices, and my impression of both the restraint chair and even the stun belt, which is another device I've reported on, is that the makers believe they were creating humane devices and that they served a purpose. Especially in a crowded jail or prison, so that, you know, when I spoke with Dan Corcoran, who's the maker of restraint chair, and it's the AEDEC restraint chair, which is the one most commonly used here, and as far as I know, it's also used in Canada. I've heard that it's being used in Newfoundland, for instance, and that there was some outcry there when that was brought in. But we were the leaders in the restraint chair, and it's used in booking rooms, in particular in jails across the country. And one of the things Dan Corcoran will say is that when a prisoner is struggling and frightened, and you cup him gently and just like a hand holding a frightened bird, and you restrain him that way, that he will calm down. And so, you know, for him, for him it was an improvement. He will say that it was an improvement on restraint boards because it was holding people upright. And he says that's safer. They won't choke on their vomit, for instance. I have no way of evaluating that specific claim. What I do know is that when I did reporting on the restraint chair, I found 11 deaths of inmates. This was back in 2000, who had been held on the restraint chair, and then they died either on the restraint chair or shortly thereafter. Amnesty International started looking at that after I did that reporting, and they found another 5 in the next year, or another 4 in the next year. This led the United Nations Committee Against Torture to ask the United States to ban that device as well as the stun belt, and that has not happened. But for the makers, they really do believe they're creating devices that help police officers and that cause fewer deaths.
Another similarity that you noted in your article was the treatment of women, specifically women who were abused sexually or raped. And you found once again that incidents such as this occur all too frequently in the United States.
Right. Well, there in Abu Ghraib, in addition to all the allegations, mostly allegations involved men, but The Guardian, the London-based Guardian, reported that senior U.S. military officials had told journalists that rape had happened in the cell block, in a particular cell block where there were also some high-value male detainees. This was back in May. And that, I knew there was a big problem with rape in the United States. So when I saw that, I knew that I didn't really have to go very far to find that. We had done some reporting at the Progressive back in 96, and this was not my reporting, but that of a woman named Bobby Stein, about guards who were letting inmates into women's cells, sometimes in exchange for payment. And, you know, if you just look at Amnesty International reports, particularly those on women, that organization reported back in 1999 that many women in prisons and jails in the United States are victims of sexual abuse. That includes everything from offensive language to rape. So, that's common.
Another thing that jumped out at me in your article was the use of a restraint pole.
This was one I particularly looked up because I knew we were using shackles a lot, and it was very interesting that Amnesty International on in looking at Abu Ghraib called attention to shackling. Because if you look at the United States, we use shackles really as a matter of course. It's commonly used. So that, and these are also in the International Reports from 1998, but women who are brought into the hospital who are in labor, in some cases even dying, may be shackled. And there are other incidents where, you know, it's not a restraint chair, but it's long-term shackling. So in Alabama, there were prisoners tied to something called, they called a hitching rail, but it was basically a kind of restraint pole where they would spend hours. And this was in particular at Julie Tutwiler Prison for Women in Alabama, where they'd been handcuffed to that rail for up to a day.
There are also cases of people being held in solitary confinement or other kinds of isolation for extended periods of time that, once again, you were able to make a connection.
When it comes to things like solitary confinement, and I've done a lot of reporting on that, because actually I did some reporting right after 2001, or September 11th, 2001. We got a letter from Frida Berrigan, who the daughter of Phil Berrigan, the famous peace activist, and she was unable to contact her father right after September 11th. The reason was that prisoners who were considered political prisoners were thrown into the hole, were thrown into solitary confinement right after the attack on the World Trade Center. This applied to people all across the country, even someone like Phil Berrigan, who is a pacifist and has never done anything knowingly violent. He was in prison for hammering on a, I believe it was a Air Force plane. And a lot of those people stayed in solitary for months. But, you know, when I saw the Red Cross report saying, you know, one of their complaints was that people were kept in solitary for 24 hours for long periods of time, it's not a funny thing, and yet it struck me as almost humorous, because here in the United States, that is par for the course at our supermaxes. It is part of our culture at this point that we have a significant portion of the our prisoners who are kept in solitary for 23 hours a day. They get 1 hour of exercise, and basically for much of their prison sentence. Here in Wisconsin, very close to here, is a supermax built in a little tiny town called Boscobel. A few years ago, in 2001, there was a class action lawsuit that was filed by those inmates. And they claimed that the facility was what they called, quote, an incubator of psychosis, end quote. There were mentally ill people being kept at that facility, and also juveniles. So I called up Ed Garvey, who's a well-known lawyer here in my state, who talked about that case. There was a court order as a result of the case that resulted in the removal of all mentally ill inmates, which he said was about a third of the prisoners kept at that facility. And he said to me, well, it's pretty interesting that the International Red Cross was upset with prisoners being held that long in solitary, because that's the case at Boscobel every day. So, you know, we actually violate the Geneva Conventions, which don't apply to American prisons,
right.
But it gives you a measuring stick. One of the things the Red Cross was also finding was that it looked like solitary confinement was contributing to psychological problems among the prisons that there. Although they also found that the interrogation was causing symptoms.
Just to clear one thing up, supermaxes,
yes,
are what exactly?
Well, our supermaxes, it's interesting that we're not a leader. That we're not the only country with these things now. My impression is that in general, with these devices that seem less humane, that might have been outlawed at different time in U.S. history, that we're a leader in the shift toward them, but that other countries are following suit. But with what I called supermaxes, these are ultra-high security prisons that are supposedly designed to house the worst of the worst. My impression from the Boscobel case is that that's not always true, that there was a man, a boy named Canyon Thixton, who had taken a car on a joyride. He was from a little rural town here called Mount Horam, who went to a prison, for this, but ended up at the Boscobel Supermax because he would fight with guards. So, but he was a juvenile, and he also became very suicidal while he was at the Supermax.
What can be done other than, you know, what we're doing here, telling people about them, these conditions? What can we do as individuals to ensure that prisoners are not treated in such a horrific manner?
I'm not sure how it is in Canada, as far as the public interest in the welfare of prisoners. I would say here, one of the things that has to start is that we have to think that that they're worth our time and our attention, because many of these prisoners come back into our communities, and if they're mistreated and dehumanized in our prisons, that's a memory they bring back. And, you know, the quality of our society involves these people who are in our jails and prisons. I also think that, you know, the public here in the United States, the public sort of tough on crime talk, that a lot of it's in the pundits who are on television, the politicians, that is contributing to a feeling that these prisoners deserve this treatment. And if enough members of the public start pointing out that they don't, that could have a change too. But it's going to take time, and it's going to take a true public and cultural turnaround, at least in